We'll see if others can. So good evening to all of you, and thank you for choosing well and joining us this evening among the available multiple choices at LSE. My name is Ruth Kattamuri. I'm the co-director of the India Observatory and Asia Research Center. We're delighted to have Jairam Ramesh this evening to speak to us on sustainable green growth challenge, not only with reference to India, but also from his international experience and perspective. I consider Jairam Ramesh to be an international thought leader. He has a varied and multidisciplinary expertise. He is a politician, an economist, a columnist, and author. He has authored Making Sense of Chindia. His latest book is titled To the Brink and Back, India's 1991 Story. He has been a researcher, political advisor, a journalist, and had even anchored some television programs in the 1990s. Now, this you don't get this every day in Indian politics. He studied mechanical engineering at IIT Mumbai. He did his master's in public policy and public management at Carnegie Mellon, and master's in economics, engineering, management, and technology policy at the MIT. Jairam was Minister of State for Environment and Forest during 2009 to 2011. The book Green Signal, Ecology, Growth, and Democracy in India, which forms the basis of today's discussion, is an interesting and insightful record of his work during this period. In this book, he describes his performance based on the Prime Minister's three-point brief to him, namely, to ensure transparency and accountability in the ministry, balancing high growth with environmental protection, and changing the global perception about India. During this time, he was involved in the international climate negotiations at the UN Conference of Parties in Cancun. The Cancun Agreement is described as follows, and I quote, "The agreement forms the pillars of the largest collective effort the world had ever seen to reduce emissions in a mutually acceptable way, with national plans captured formally at international level. It included the most comprehensive package ever agreed by governments to help developing nations deal with climate change. It encompassed finance, technology, and capacity building support to help countries meet urgent needs to adapt to climate change and to speed up their plans to adopt sustainable paths to low emissions economies that could also resist the negative impacts of climate change." And quote end. So Jairam demonstrated strong leadership for representing the concerns of developing countries and made significant contributions toward this form of the agreement to happen in Cancun. The Guardian wrote on 2nd July 2015, "Jairam Ramesh was a self-described economic hawk when he became India's environment minister in 2009, figuring that the country's ecological problems could wait as India lifted its people out of poverty. But by the time he left his post in 2011, he had become an environmental hawk after witnessing how India's rapidly expanding economy and soaring population had caused widespread pollution and destruction of the environment." And I'm quoting The Guardian, so Jairam can say if it's true or not. "As chair of the Future Earth Engagement Committee and various other positions with the government of France, Jairam will be involved with COP21 in Paris in December 2015. So now we look forward to hearing his thoughts on the Sustainable Green Growth Challenge. Over to you.
Sure. Thank you, Ruth. I'm not so sure that environmental hawk is a good description. Perhaps an economic hawk and an environmental dove might be a more appropriate description, but I hadn't actually read that. I'll do it right now. Well, first of all, let me thank you for being here. As Ruth said, you have a variety of options, and green growth in India, not exactly a very exciting option to spend an evening on, but I thought it's particularly relevant issue, given the fact that we are going to go in for international climate change discussions in a month from now, and everybody's eyes really are on India. They were on China a couple of years ago. China has moved, and now everybody is looking at India and what India has to offer. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to speak for about 20 minutes or so, and we'll have about an hour thereabouts for questions and answers. So make this a little more interactive rather than a speech formally. The anchor, the peg for what I'm going to mention to you is this book that came out earlier this year, published by the Oxford University Press, which really encapsulates the 25 months that I was Minister for Environment and the battles that I had to fight in trying to integrate environmental concerns with growth concerns, because politically and in every other respect, no government can afford to abandon the pursuit of high economic growth as the central objective of policy. So the real question is that how do you make this high economic growth inclusive in terms of social terms and sustainable ecologically? So that's really the crux of the challenge that I faced, and this book is a description on various issues that came up in the process of integrating these concerns. Let me begin by asking the obvious question, which is, why is sustainable growth and why is green growth particularly important for India? This is a question that may be obvious outside India, but there is a vigorous debate on this within India, because in India the dominant discourse has been that poverty, unemployment, backwardness requires India to sustain a high rate of economic growth, and we should follow the traditional grow now, pay later model, which the US has followed, which the Chinese have followed, which the Brazilians have followed, which is sustain high economic growth for 25 to 30 year period, and then worry about the consequences of that growth later, clean up later after an 8% growth or thereabouts for three decades. So why should India be an exception to the grow now, pay later model? And that in fact was the first challenge that I faced, is how to convince my own colleagues in government and the larger community, the intellectual discourse in India, which traditionally has seen environment as a Western plot to keep India in a state of perpetual poverty and backwardness, as an elitist middle class issue, which we cannot really afford to pay attention to at this stage of economic development. So this question, which may appear obvious to most of you, is still very central to the intellectual discourse within India. So why green growth? Why sustainable growth? Why, in fact, bring in the element of sustainability in this single-minded pursuit of economic growth? And to my mind, as I worked through my own tenure, it struck me that there were four overriding reasons why India must make a departure from the conventional grow now, pay later model. The first and most obvious reason is a demographic reason. We are today 1.24 billion, and by the year 2050, we would be 1.7 billion. In other words, we're going to be adding a third of our current population in the next 25 to 30 years. Now, if you define sustainability mathematically as the ability of the current generation to meet its consumption needs without jeopardizing the ability of future generations to meet their consumption needs, then India has a lot to worry about. Many countries do not have future generations to think about as they face either stable populations or declining populations, but India is going to add, as I said, a third of its current population over the next 25 to 30 years. So it has to worry about more than most other countries in the world, in fact more than China, because China is already in a declining population trajectory. So the demographic reason, the fact that we are by the year 2022, in just 7 years' time, going to be the world's most populous country, and continue to grow, and not only continue to grow quantitatively, but continue to grow with a median age hovering around 28 or 29, which means that the consumption patterns of an aging economy are quite different from the consumption patterns of an economy which has a young population structure. So the demographic argument is the first argument. The second argument is the climate change argument, that climate change, there is no country in the world which has the type of vulnerabilities to climate change that India has. India may not have contributed to global warming. The stock of greenhouse gas emissions, largely a contribution of the US and the Western economies. But certainly in terms of vulnerabilities across multiple dimensions, no country like India which has this vulnerability. The monsoon, which is so very critical to the Indian economy, given the fact that one in two Indians still depend on agriculture for their livelihoods. The fact that 60% of India, even after all its irrigation is harnessed, will continue to be rain-fed. So the dependence on the monsoon. Number two, the dependence on the glaciers for water security, particularly in the perennial rivers of North India. And now the retreat of the glaciers being an accepted scientific fact, the impact that has on snow melt and the availability of water in the North Indian river system. Third, the fact that you have over 200 million people living along a 7,000 kilometer long coastline, vulnerable to increase in mean sea levels, which is also now a scientifically proven, robust conclusion from all the IPCC studies. And fourth, the fact that most of our natural resources, most particularly coal, iron ore, bauxite, is located in our forest areas. And therefore, the more you extract your natural resources, which you need to sustain a high rate of economic growth, you will have a double whammy, because you will deforest, which would lead to global warming. You would use the coal, which would also then lead to global warming. So if you look at the indices or the dimensions of vulnerability, very few countries in the world, I would say no country in the world really, has these multiple dimensions of vulnerability that India has. So the second argument for India making a departure from the grow now, pay later model, the first is a demographic argument, the second is the climate change argument. The third pressing argument for India to make a change is the public health argument, that no longer is environment an environment issue in the conventional sense of the term as is normally understood in the rest of the world. It's having now profound public health consequences. It has impacts on morbidity, it has impacts on mortality, water pollution, air pollution, soil contamination, all are extracting a huge public health cost across the country. And it is this that is driving the importance of environment, and it is this that is driving the public concern on environment. People may not articulate it as environmental issues. It's articulated as health issues. It's articulated as issues relating to the consequences of the, as I said, the pollution of water, air, and soil. But certainly, it has a public health dimension. And fourth, in reason why we must be different is, more than most countries in the world, environmental issues in India have less to do with lifestyles and more to do with livelihoods. More and more environmental issues are issues relating to water, issues relating to land, issues relating to forests, which are ultimately the foundations of livelihood security for millions of Indians, particularly vulnerable, those belonging to vulnerable and weaker sections of society, like the tribal communities. So here are four overriding reasons why India must be different. Demographically, climate change, public health, and the livelihood security argument. Now, having tried to create this overall discourse around these four issues, the question then really arises, how do you integrate growth imperatives with environmental concerns? Between 2004 and 2014, the Indian economy grew at an annual average rate of 7.5% per year. Now, we need to grow at about 8 to 8.5% per year in order to create the jobs that are required. India needs to create almost 8 million jobs a year, because that's the number of Indians who are entering the labor force year after year. So it's only through high economic growth, sustained over a long period of time, that you're going to be able to generate the employment required for your young population. So that's one part of the equation. But if you accept the four overriding reasons that I have enumerated, then the real question is, not only do we need to grow at 7.5 to 8% at a very minimum, but we have to ensure that in the process of this growth, we are not going to impose an intolerable burden on our environmental wealth, on our water, on our land, on our forests, on our mountains, and on our glaciers. So how do we bring about this integration? And this book really, in a way, is a story of that integration. Now, clearly, there are some rules, there are some ground rules that come out of my own experience as to how we need to bring about this integration. First and foremost is that you need regulations. You need a regulatory edifice. And this is not something that you can leave to economic agents. This is not something that you leave for self-regulation. So the importance of regulation, the importance of regulatory instruments, the importance of laws, the importance of standards to drive economic agents along a particular path of environmental decision-making has come out very, very clearly from my own experience. Second is the importance of institutions, the governance of environmental issues. Institutions at the local level, institutions at the state level, and certainly institutions at the federal level. Now, by institutions, I don't mean necessarily government institutions. Eleanor Ostrom, who got the Nobel Prize in Economics a couple of years ago for her work on the commons in Nepal, in the Himalayan watersheds of Nepal and northern India, Eleanor Ostrom argued that the economics literature is full of a binary, that you either have private institutions or you have public institutions, whereas the more successful instances of management of the commons has to deal with institutions of communities, that not necessarily market-driven institutions or government-led institutions, but institutions that are self-governing and which emanate from a local community. So when I use the word institution, it's not just private sector or government sector, but also institutions of communities which have control over management of water, management of forests, management of land, and so on and so forth. So first is the importance of regulations, laws and standards. Second is the importance of institutions. Third, and this is very significant, and this is of great contemporary relevance, which is the processes of resolving contradictions and conflicts. Because we should not have any illusions. The process of integrating environment and growth does involve trade-offs, does involve making choices. It does involve contradictions. It does involve conflicts. And the only way to do this is through the democratic process. Because the political system in which decision-making is embedded in India is a democratic system. So this democratic system has to be the vehicle for mediating conflicts when it comes. This political system has to be this vehicle for making these choices, the trade-offs between environment on the one hand and growth on the other. So the strengthening of democratic institutions and the use of democratic processes, legislatures, locally elected bodies, parliament, political parties, civil society organizations, the judiciary, all institutions of governance, of democratic governance, play a very important role in ensuring that there is a balance of growth on the one side and environment on the other. So these are the three broad rules of decision making that you will see in this book. The importance of the regulatory system, the importance of the institutional framework, and third, the importance of the democratic institutions of governance as instruments of resolving conflicts which are inevitable in the processes of integration. So I think India is at a historic moment right now. We are a latecomer to the high growth club. It's only in the last decade that India has averaged an annual growth rate of 7.5%. And over 70% of the infrastructure that India needs for the year 2050 remains to be built. So the choice before India is really a strategic choice. Do you do it in the manner in which the US, the Chinese and the Brazilians have done? Or do you do it in a different manner, which not only gives you the growth and the infrastructure, but also enables you to exercise leadership on the environmental front? And that's really the challenge, and that's what the Paris Conference of Parties particularly is all about. I mean, is India going to show a different path, or is India going to follow the same path which other economies have followed with great consequences for growth and consumption, but fairly disastrous consequences as far as environment and natural resources are concerned? So I'll stop here. The main message that I wish to convey is this, that growth in India has to be rapid. But for growth to be rapid alone is not sufficient. Growth has to be sustainable for the variety of reasons that I have mentioned to you. And this sustainability is not at a philosophical level. The sustainability has to be reflected in the nature of investment choices, in the nature of technology choices that we make. And I think this, in today's environment, particularly where the entire attention of the world is focused on climate change, biodiversity protection, and the protection of many other planetary boundaries, I think India has a historic opportunity for demonstrating leadership in an area that, you know, traditionally has not been alien to the Indian cultural ethos, but for some reason it has not got reflected in the priorities as far as economic planning is concerned. So I'd be more than happy and glad to take any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to pick up on where you left off, and by saying that India, it's an opportunity for India to show leadership in finding a different path of infrastructure development and investment. Are there any thoughts or any suggestions that you can make at this point?
Well, let me give you one concrete example of what I mean. Let's take solar energy. Germany has no business being a world leader in solar energy. 6 months, there's no sun in Germany. But Germany has 12 times the solar capacity that India has. 37 gigawatts is the total solar capacity in Germany. 3 gigawatts is the total solar capacity in India. 30% of Germany's electricity supply on a daily basis comes from renewable sources. 30%. And Germany is not a Denmark or a Norway. You know, it's 80 million people, world's most industrialized economy, world's leading trading country. So this is an example. I mean, here is an example of a choice that is available with costs coming down. This was not true 10 years ago. But today, costs are coming down. And the question really is that, do we have the courage to say we're going to make a departure from the fossil fuel trajectory of growth, which all economies have actually grown, and take advantage of this technological revolution that is taking place in the world. So I think, as I said earlier, there are some advantages to being latecomers. And one advantage of being a latecomer is that you don't have to repeat the mistakes of the others. You know.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'll open it. I'll have more questions, but I give others a chance. You, I think, did an incredible task of governance, of trying to bring together the multiple sectors, or the commons, as you said. You tried to engage with the civil society, with public, private, and that was a big challenge, and you know, there was, I think it was a tremendous task, and you're mentioning about how democracy can work and things like that, but what I'd like to hear about is some insights from that difficulty of bringing these together.
Well, I paid the price for it, you know. At the end of 25 months, I was kicked upstairs. I became a cabinet minister. But an environment minister who has friends has not done his job. The job of an environment minister is to not consciously make enemies, but the nature of the job is such that you end up pleasing nobody. So, you know, as Henry Kissinger once said, the true test of a policy is balanced dissatisfaction. You know, is everybody equally dissatisfied? And then you've done your job. So in all these issues, I mean, I'll give you a couple of examples which will resonate with you, because these are the debates that have taken place in this country as well. Genetically modified crops. What should we do on genetically modified crops? Should we have, you know, one of the first things that I had on my desk when I became minister was genetically modified aubergine, brinjal. Genetically modified brinjal. I mean, the Indians in this hall will relate to brinjal. You know, it's a staple diet in Indian food. And Monsanto wanted to introduce a new variety of brinjal on the grounds that you know, food security would be enhanced. Now I asked myself this question: what does brinjal have to do with food security? I can understand rice, I can understand wheat, I can understand pulses, but brinjal, aubergine, and food security doesn't make sense. So we had this debate for a year and a half. And at the end of which, you know, I consulted 8,000 people, had public hearings, which was an unusual way of decision making, in 8 cities of India, had 8 public hearings, all this I have described, and got different people, their voices, and at the end of that exercise, I came to the conclusion that it's a food crop. So therefore one has to be careful, and so a moratorium was imposed on the commercialization of BT brinjal, which has, by the way, been there for the last 5 years, and nobody has removed that moratorium. We had a very famous case of bauxite mining, and which led to the one positive impact of that was that I met Bianca Jagger for the first time, because she was a great sort of spokesman for Vedanta, which is a company which is listed in the London Stock Exchange. And they were mining bauxite in a mountain which was considered sacred by 4,000 people. 4,000 people. Now, in a democracy, I mean, I was told by my colleagues that majority, you know, you should go by the will of the majority. But in democracy, you also have to listen to small minority groups, you know. That's what democracy is all about. So I just said, no, we can't allow this to happen, because this is a hill which is considered to be a goddess as far as this tribal community is concerned. You want a bauxite, you go and buy the bauxite somewhere or mine somewhere else, but you can't mine here. That created a big furor. Many things like this. A new airport in Bombay, which was going to submerge the mangroves in Bombay. And the mangroves is the most powerful bio shield against tsunamis. You know, my own colleague said that, you know, I'm stopping progress. But I said, you can have an airport, but tell me, how are you going to protect the mangroves? How are you going to do some compensatory work as far as these mangroves are concerned. So I think what I tried to do was debunk this notion that environment is a technocratic issue. You know, environment is not just a technocratic issue. It's an issue of livelihoods. It's an issue that affects people on a day-to-day basis. So people must be involved in the decision making. How do you involve people in decision making when dams are being built, people are being relocated, large areas are being submerged, people are not going to be heard? We have a system of environmental regulation where public hearings are essential before a decision is taken. And I found that very often you had public no hearings, and where you had the hearings, public was not there at all. You know, so I think the main thing. I mean, today one of the things that has happened, at least I think as a consequence of that, is that environment is now a political issue. It's fairly and squarely part of the political agenda. Political parties are talking about air pollution. Political parties are talking about protection of rivers. Political parties are talking about protection of tribal livelihoods, which is a good thing. But I think if once it becomes part of the political discourse, then chances are that some of these choices will get made. I mean, not all the choices you will be happy with, but at least it would be made transparently and in a manner that people can relate to.